Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
And welcome to our third day of the 10 days of Oscars here. And I am the outlaw, John Roca, joined as always by my co-host on the Cinephile, Steve Morris. How are you, Steve?
I'm good. I'm steeped in the magic of Hollywood, John.
Absolutely. We are caught up in the afterglow of last night's Oscars ceremony. And we are recording these every day, about a half an hour conversation about one of the Best Picture nominees. And it just happened to fall. Maybe we scheduled it this way. Oppenheimer is the conversation for today. The winner of 7 Academy Awards last night, starring Cillian Murphy, who won the Best Actor Oscar Award, directed by Christopher Nolan, who won the Best Director Award. Oh, I guess I should say spoilers if you didn't see the Oscars.
Yeah.
And Oppenheimer, which won Best Picture overall. It also stars Emily Blunt, Matt Damon, Robert Downey Jr., who won the Best Supporting Actor Oscar, Florence Pugh, Josh Hartnett, Casey Affleck, Rami Malek, Kenneth Branagh, and my personal favorite actor in the movie, David Krumholtz, with cinematography by Hoyt van Hoytema, edited by Jennifer Lame, who won the Oscar last night. Ludwig Göransson did the score, who won the Oscar last night as well. And a film that ended up grossing almost $1 billion at the theater, Steve, off a $100 million budget, if you can believe that, and tells the story of J. Robert Oppenheimer, of course, created the atomic bomb, and everything involved with creating of the bomb and the aftermath of that bomb as well. So, Steve, I've watched this film 6 times now.
Wow.
And counting. And I know this is one that you enjoyed and we've talked about as well. So what are your overall thoughts here on Oppenheimer as we move into 2024 fully and now move out of all the 2023 movies here with the ending of the Oscars?
So one thing I think we've talked about for years on the Cinephiles, and was our mission statement on the Cinephiles, was we didn't want to elevate one genre or over another. We felt that making a great comedy or a great horror film was just as important, just as entertaining, just as hard, just as worthy of our critique as making a great drama or something else. But for me, there are certain films that should be Best Picture.
Yeah,
that are the and it's not that my favorite movie of the year might be American Fiction,
right?
But the movie that should win Best Picture is Oppenheimer, because there is a certain kind of film that is large in scope, technically difficult, involves deep, complex emotions, wrestles with difficult and powerful ideas, and brings an artistic vision in a way that nothing else does. And when I saw it in the theater in IMAX for the first time, I went. And I remember specifically the moment where I went, this is a great film and this should win Best Picture. And then this is the only one, because I don't get enough time to watch as many movies as you do. Mm. This is the only one of the Oscar nominees I watched again. I watched it in my home on the 4K Blu-ray, which, by the way, might very well be the greatest 4K Blu-ray I've ever seen, like in terms of picture, in terms of sound quality. It's just off the charts. And as I'm watching it, my thought is like, is this as good as I thought? Am I going to like this? Am I going to admire the filmmaking as much as I did? And hell yes, I did. It is absolutely as good as I thought, if not better. This is a fantastic film.
Yeah, I have to agree with you. Overall, a film that every time I watch it, leaves me haunted with the questions that they bring up in the film and the conversations they have in the film about what led to the creation of this atomic bomb, that it was a combination of his ego and desire to leave a legacy that would be well known into the future, and also America's desire to create this ultimate weapon in order to end the war as quickly as possible, or so they said. And so to see both of these, shall I say, selfish interests coming together in order to create something like this, being spurred on by the scientific challenge and the scientific possibilities here, and the desire to essentially kind of almost like Rubik's Cube this thing and figure it out and put it together and make it happen with all these incredible minds coming together and all these possible things and all these possible pitfalls that they were able to manage and troubleshoot and get out of in order to achieve this goal, and then seeing the effect on the world after what he had wrought. Both that scene when he has the big standing ovation and everybody is going crazy and cheering for him there in the stands, and that whole what that does to him as he steps onto the charred body of one of the victims of his bomb, to that meeting with Gary Oldman as the great Harry S. Truman there, to where he's sitting there fighting for his security clearance, which is the back and forth part of this movie. All of it just kind of showing you the weight of what he did and the consequences of what he did and how it changed him as a human being. So there's this, it's a cautionary tale in many ways, in one of the grandest stages you could possibly have a cautionary tale being told. And Steve, I will have to say, like, Cillian Murphy's performance here, we have to talk about it. He won the Best Actor Oscar over Paul Giamatti in The Holdovers, who seemed to be his closest contender for the award as well. But what an incredible performance from a guy we've seen in TV shows like Peaky Blinders and assorted other movies, certainly the Batman trilogy under Christopher Nolan's direction, stuff like Red Eye and other things that he's done. But this is when an actor finds that moment, is offered that part that takes them to the next level. I don't know if it means that Cillian's going to go and do a bunch of other things now that he's a lead actor Oscar, best actor Oscar winner, but it certainly shows you that this man has incredible talent and was waiting for the right material to have it come out. What were your thoughts on Cillian's performance here as J. Robert Oppenheimer throughout this movie?
It was so strange to watch him accept the award and see him as he is, having watched Money, the movies and stuff that you've mentioned, and then of course watching him Oppenheimer. Well, I mean, one of the things about him, he has one of the most recognizably intense faces.
Yeah, those
that
eyes.
It's just so striking, and that lends him to be put into these roles that are more intense, you know, like going all the way back to the Scarecrow of like, yes, because you can't stop looking at him.
Right.
And so, and then in this role, I really think, and I don't want to hit this as hard as sounds like I'm going to hit it, because I don't know that I'm there yet. Mm-hmm. But in terms of the complexity of the character, the mix of the ego and the insecurities, mm-hmm. the mix of the passion and being lost and also being believing he's right and taking things too far, and the arrogance and all those mixes, the other performance that it makes me think of is T.E. Lawrence, is Peter O'Toole, because it's got all of that same sort of insecurity and ego and drive and complexity. And that's why I say Peter O'Toole's performance as Lawrence of Arabia stands the test of time.
Yes.
I'm not ready to say that. There's a reason we take 10 years before we put a movie on the cinephiles, because great films have to be reckoned with. I'm not there yet, but I think this is in the same direction. And in particular, the way that we meet him as a young man who is deeply conflicted and insecure, and then the growing confidence and the sense of who he is, but also those self-destructive qualities, those mistakes that he makes, his inability to see the reality of his communist ties, of the people that he's working with. Like, oh man, that picture you just brought up. I mean, the eyes. I mean, it's like this intensity is there.
Yeah.
And this guy who is his own worst enemy many times. And I do want to go back, by the way, just to one thing you said, just at the very beginning of, you're absolutely right about the ego that drove him to build the bomb and the needs, the political needs of the United States to build the bomb. But we also have to add, like, this is a Jewish man and the Holocaust is happening.
Yes.
And the question is how close were the Nazis to developing a bomb? And if the Nazis had developed a bomb before us, we might be living in a completely different world today. And so, like, and this is the unknowableness of this decision to build the atomic bomb, and the final moment with Einstein, which I don't know if we're spoiling that, but like that stunning moment of thinking about what have we wrought? And the answer is, we will never have an answer of whether this was right or wrong or what would have happened. We've created, you know, Pandora is out of the box. We've loosed destruction on the earth, and now we're going to reap what we've sown, and we will never know whether it was the right decision or not.
Yeah. Well, I think that's why I come back to the film over and over again, because it is, not only does it deal with a man who is consumed by this terrible form of mental health, like this from the beginning, and if you do research on Oppenheimer, he is a man who considered taking his own life a number of times because he was persecuted by these visions, persecuted by this thing that he could see the world in a completely different way than everyone else could see, which would drive a person crazy. You would think that that would be a great thing, to be able to see things other people can't see. But the natural desire for human beings is to connect and to have conversation about these things that they experience. And if there's no one to share with, because no one else sees it the way you do, it can be a very lonely existence if you don't have a strong enough spirit to deal with being different from everybody else. And so we see that the film starts out that way. And so we start to feel and connect to him. And he almost kills his professor, which is an accurate story. And then see where he goes from there and how he finally finds his way, the hat, the pipe, everything, the relationship with Florence Pugh's character, how that shapes him at a time in his life when he's looking to feel this ego of youth and strength and confidence in his intelligence, to his transition into that marriage with Emily Blunt and what happens with her, them back and forth with Kitty and the back and forth and all of that, and what it leads to when he creates the bomb and shepherds all these scientists with Matt Damon's help, of course, along the way, bringing all these people together, and finds his true strength and confidence and leadership in guiding them all to creating this bomb. And Steve, you know, being in a room full of intellectuals, getting them all to go in one direction must be an incredibly difficult thing. And then have them all put aside their egos, put aside their alpha instincts to surrender their alphaness to Oppenheimer, I think was an incredible thing to witness. And Cillian Murphy's performance as he unwrapped these layers of Oppenheimer as the film went along was a marvel to witness. Obviously, with the companionship of Christopher Nolan's direction, leading him in that direction, decorating the film with what he was decorating with, so that it led you into this point, I thought was incredible. And then all those scenes afterwards, where he is really caught up in the pain and the anger and the guilt of what he had done. And I watched a couple of documentaries after the film came out. And you can see that there is a lot of haunting pain within Oppenheimer's eyes. You talk about the intensity of his eyes. The intensity of his eyes before he builds the bomb and the intensity of his eyes after he builds the bomb, I think is a marvel to look at when you're looking at acting from Cillian Murphy in the film.
So I actually read this book, Oppenheimer, the Modern Prometheus. I read it years ago, and I wish, you know, had I had the strength, I would have read it closer to when the movie came out. I didn't. I wish I had a better memory. But the big thing I remember is like the skill to be able to visualize and understand and work in the world of atomic physics and quantum mechanics, and the skill to be a leader among people and organize resources and do those usually don't find their way into the same human. They're just not the same. The fact that he has to be a person that understands this stuff, and he has to be a person that all these other geniuses, and these are a lot of geniuses coming up, they all have to respect them. And then he also has to work with Matt Damon and the government. By the way, one of my favorite Matt Damon performances. I think, because what's so great is seeing someone who began as a movie star, and of course is still a movie star, and comes in and plays pitch perfect utility role in this movie. Like top to bottom, he's great. And like watching that all happen, and then also, and Nolan does such a perfect job of this, of the continual peppering of, is this the right thing to do? How dangerous is this? What about the hydrogen bomb? You know, because that's one of the big things that comes out of, like, because the atomic bomb is tiny compared to the hydrogen bomb that we built, you know, thousands of times more powerful in the long run. And like the all wrestling with all of that is so powerful. And then in addition to that, all of the stuff about communism. But by the way, I had a crazy thought, which is, and I talked to my mom about it, which is, so this is a Jewish man in very, very well known in the 30s, 40s, and 50s in San Francisco, in the Bay Area. that's where my family is. And so my great grandfather was a well-known man about town in the 30s, 40s, and 50s in San Francisco. And so I asked my mom, do you think that Pop-Pop, my great-grandfather, Harry Hilp, actually met Oppenheimer? And my mom said, it's possible, because they were, if there were events, like big events, they might have been the same event. But Pop-Pop, my great-grandfather, would have hated Oppenheimer because he was a conservative capitalist Republican, and this guy was a crazy intellectual communist. They would not have gotten along. It's just something I was thinking about, like, oh, my family was around at this time.
Well, that's a perfect segue to discuss Robert Downey Jr.'s performance and the role that he plays in the film as someone who grows to hate Oppenheimer. And it, of course, detail, this is based on an actual character, or this is the actual Rear Admiral Louis Strauss and his experiences with Oppenheimer as he was the ranking member of the U.S. Atomic Energy Commission, and clearly taking out a lot of his past slights, both perceived and real, from Oppenheimer through this process as we go back and forth in the movie. Won the Best Supporting Actor Oscar, first Oscar he's ever won there, Robert Downey Jr., after being nominated three times, including this one. So what are your thoughts on how they portray, how Robert Downey Jr. portrayed Louis Strauss, and how he is used in this, in the movie, as this antagonist, and then event, and essentially, sorry, initially friendly a person, and then turning into his antagonist by the by as the movie goes along?
I think going from Tony Stark to this guy just shows, I think
that's great.
First of all, it shows this is a great actor. We've always known he was a great actor from the beginning. We knew he was a great actor, but it, this what shows his range, because you go from this uber charismatic, incredibly, you know, egotistical to a fault, totally confident person, to this guy who's just driven by these senses of being slighted and insecurity and pettiness and all this stuff. And I love the physical transformation. I love that he went for this not attractive look. And I think it does also relate. My only criticism of the film.
My only criticism of the film
is that I wish, you know, we're in this sort of flashback structure. We're seeing pieces of the interrogation and testimony and pieces of the future in terms of post-war stuff. And then we return to making the bomb. We go back and forth. And I wish editorially, and I'm sure they have reasons for this, and I would love to talk to the editor who also won the Oscar of why the choice was. I wish they had moved the explosion of the atomic bomb, and in particular, that incredible scene that you mentioned before of the celebration at Los Alamos, later in the film.
Oh, interesting.
So that it was close, because to me, there's that is the climax of the film. That scene, I think people are going to be studying that celebration scene at film schools for the rest of history. I think it is among the great, brilliant sequences of film in terms of sound design, in terms of the visuals, because it feels like a celebration, but then you start to hear it, starts, things start vibrating like we're in the bomb explosion. And you, as you mentioned, we see the ashes and the bodies, and you see people laughing, but then they're crying, and they're so, and it is so mixed and complicated. I think it's amazing. And that to me is the climax of the film. And because of that, while everything that happens after, which is probably a half hour, 40 minutes of stuff, is fantastic and well acted, it's at a lesser level for me. So I wish you could have moved that moment later. It's because we have a flashback structure anyway. There's no real point reason why. That being said, watching the understanding of who Robert Downey Jr.'s character is pretending to be, who he really is, what his real motivations are, what's really happening to them, and then back to this Einstein-Oppenheimer moment that reveals that nothing was what he thought it was in the first place. You know? I think it's great.
Agreed. I think it's absolutely fantastic. And there, the process that he goes through, Robert Downey Jr., aided along by Alden Ehrenreich, you know, a fantastic performance from him as well, as his aide, and how he turns on the whole situation as we see the big switch. And this is one of the best performances of Robert Downey Jr.'s career. Obviously, getting nominated, getting the award for it, getting the Oscar for it, validates that. He's won the new, a bunch of other awards for this performance as well. And I hope there's more to come in this vein from Robert Downey Jr. Loved him as Tony Stark. I think he gets unfairly maligned for his performances in those movies, because I think he's fantastic in those films. But this is something that I think shows you that there is a master actor waiting for Robert, as he transitions now, Steve, into these older times. I mean, even last night watching him accept the awards, you can see the man is getting older. You can hear it in his voice. You can see it in his movements. He's getting older. So where are you going to go next? You can't play Tony Stark forever. So where are these roles that are going to pop up? And I think there's a real window that we saw in this performance that there's 20 to 30 years left of Robert Downey Jr. performances as he ages into these roles, ages into these characters. And I think it's going to be fun to see with him. What about Emily Blunt? What did you think of her performance here? She was also nominated as a best supporting actress here in the role of Catherine Kitty Oppenheimer. Initially, it felt like to me there was not enough of an introduction for her. It's one of the few criticisms I have of the movie. And then as the film goes along, we see her really grab center stage there. And certainly leading up to that confrontation she has at the security hearing when she takes on Jason Clarke's character, Roger Robb, in a back and forth. So what are your thoughts on Emily Blunt's character here or her work in the film?
I think the performance is great, obviously. In particular, the scene where she confronts him and he's like at the tree, sitting at the tree. And like, the thing that I really like about their relationship, and this is true with the Florence Pugh relationship too. I think that performance is equally as good to Emily Blunt's performance, is that she gets Oppenheimer. And Oppenheimer is not an easy person to get. Yeah. I think she has him sort of nailed, if that makes sense. You know what I mean? Like she really understands him. And knows that she, you know, it's so funny. We have these two movies, this movie and Maestro, which we think of, the sexual revolution happened in the late 60s and in the 70s. And Maestro and Oppenheimer go, no, people were fucking around all the time.
People were fucking around for a long time. Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
otherwise, there'd be no people, you know? So like the fact that we have this, you know, he's having this relationship, this very odd relationship with Florence Pugh, where he wants more and she, what's going on with her, we don't quite understand. And then he meets this woman who's out of one marriage, went into another marriage, is now obviously going to have an affair with Oppenheimer. And then Oppenheimer goes and talks to her husband and we work out a deal. And she, you know, she gets pregnant out of wedlock and all that. So it's like,
which is
a lot of stuff going on, a lot of shit going on here. And I think, like, to me, I think that I'm happy with the person who did win Best Supporting Actress, but Emily Blunt is fantastic in the film. In particular, both those scenes, the one that I'm talking about at the tree, and then her standing up for Oppenheimer as everyone's coming after him is great.
Yeah, I agree. I think you make a great point about Florence Pugh. I shouldn't leave her out. She was stellar in this role. And I saw some people getting upset with the unnecessary nudity. Get out of here. This is a woman who's very comfortable in her own body and has no problem being nude in certain scenes. And the sex scene with her and Cillian Murphy there at the hearing that Kitty is visualizing, I think that was an essential scene to show what she sees when she looks at him and how the anger of that really frustrates her. And we as an audience see her being in that position because it helps us think that she's not going to step up to the plate, that she's not going to defend him, that she's not going to be able to go toe-to-toe because her anger will overtake that and she might turn on him in the hearing. So I kind of love that we have all of that going on in those moments, in those interactions, and in those scenes with Florence Pugh. And of course, there are rumors that she was killed and that it wasn't that she drowned herself. So that's also a questionable thing as we see possibly a hand pushing her down.
Definitely.
The bathtub. Yeah. So that was a whole thing for as well.
I want to respond just to the nudity thing, because we just get really tied up in ideas and politics and stuff like that. And it's like there was a time under the Hayes Code where we couldn't show any nudity, obviously, no reference to sex, all that stuff. And then there was this time in the mid to late 60s where suddenly went, hey, we can make movies and actually explore other areas of humans. And that was fantastic. To open up part of the human condition and say, no, we can look at this. It's okay. You know, and then a whole bunch of people went, ooh, young boys like to see naked women. And we got all of the exploitation. And so that's say, hey, that exploitation, that was maybe not such a good thing. Right. Like it wasn't respectful of the women. It wasn't healthy. It was objectifying, all that stuff.
True.
And then we go, and then this mindset happens. So like, therefore, let's shut all the nudity down. Yeah. Let's shut all the sex down. And that's not right. The way that sex isn't a part of this film, and the way it is handled and the way it is used feels real and human and honest and not exploitive in any way. And particularly because it's not just her that's naked. Oppenheimer is naked. And I will tell you, I said there was a moment in this film where I went, this is a great film. Mm. And this is what the moment is. He He's being interrogated. Yeah. Emily Blunt is behind him. And then we cut to him naked with Florence Pugh, and their sex. And then he is naked being interrogated.
Yes.
And then they're having sex in the interrogation room with his wife watching on. And I went at that moment, I'm like, this is a fucking great film.
Yeah.
Because that is a filmmaker making a choice. And it is not a realistic choice. It is a choice that says he is being exposed in this room by these people in the same way it would be if they were watching him have sex. Yeah. And we are seeing that visually. And you cannot have that moment without showing them naked. This moment only exists, and it's not a purient moment. It is a deeply emotional, personal moment that's unlike anything else that has ever been put on film. That particular moment, I think, is fantastic.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, the puritanical approach to this nonsense is frustrating on so many levels, because it's not about about exploiting. And if a film radiates that, it shouldn't be done. But if a film uses it in the way that they use it in this film, as you said, then it's effective and it's necessary as part of the movie. Just because you don't want to see it doesn't mean it isn't necessary. I don't want to see a bunch of Jews being killed, Jewish people being killed in Schindler's List, but I have to watch it in order to understand what the director is trying to tell me and show me in this movie. I don't want to hear the Auschwitz noises when I'm watching Zone of Interest, but I have to hear them in order to understand what the director is showing me. So there's things that you may not want to see, but you need to see to understand what the filmmaker is trying to say. And let's move on to that, Steve, because we've talked all around this filmmaker, but Christopher Nolan here winning the Best Director Oscar for this film. I said this when I came out of Oppenheimer, that I thought it was his magnum opus. It was his greatest film ever. And I stand by that still. Every time I watch, it becomes so much more evident that he used almost every tool in his toolbox to create this incredible film visually, editing-wise, acting-wise, all the things he was able to bring together, production design, everything, how he was able to bring it all together and deliver an incredible film that caught the attention of so many people and kept us riveted in our seats, even though it's a film about a 1940s scientist creating the atom bomb and what happens afterwards. I thought Nolan did a wonderful job directing this movie. What did you think of his direction throughout the film?
So, I think Christopher Nolan is a genius, but I am not. When I would ask my students at film school, who's your favorite director? Almost every semester, the half of the class said Christopher Nolan.
Wow. Like,
yeah, absolutely. And we know from the surveys we've done with the cinephiles, Christopher Nolan is a lot of people's favorite director.
Yes.
He's not my favorite director. Hmm. And the reason is, up until Oppenheimer. And the reason is he does great stuff. Yeah. He has incredible talent. He has incredible visual style. And he sometimes gets obsessed with very, very clever ideas that to me end up feeling empty on multiple viewings, you know? And it's not that I don't like these movies, but it's like, yeah, you love messing time in particular. He loves to mess with time, whether it's in what's the crazy back and forth Tenet. Yeah, but he's messing in time when we're in Dreams, and we're messing with time when we're in Memento, and we're messing in time in Interstellar. And it's like these are all like him, and he has these huge, incredible visual set pieces, incredible sound, and it's just taking you away. And then there are times where I look at it and go, wait, but what really happened? Like, was I emotionally involved in that? And in films like Dunkirk, which I really, really like, it's also one of my favorites, where he isn't messing around as much and just telling a story, I was really involved in. When the announcement of Oppenheimer was made, my first thought was, basically, if Christopher Nolan could use all of his powers and genius to tell a personal story, a big personal story, but a personal story, it could be his greatest film. And that is exactly what I think happened. I think all of that skill, all that craftsmanship, all that understanding of the filmmaking art came together to tell an important and serious story about a complex character in a very complex world. And I think he hit it out of the park.
Absolutely. And I think no scene drives that home. Well, I think there's two or three scenes that drive that home. Certainly, we've already talked about this scene here that I thought was incredibly well directed. But I think we also have to look at this, the scenes in the Senate and the scenes that are going on here with black and white. I mean, vacillating between black and white to color was such a brilliant decision by Nolan that I thoroughly enjoyed. You know, we're in the middle of doing Raging Bull right now, Steve, as we're recording this. So we're seeing a master filmmaker like Martin Scorsese use black and white to his credit and to the credit of the film. What are your thoughts when you see his usage of black and white in the movie here in this vacillating between the color and the black and white?
I think, wouldn't it be cool if we had somehow reached the end of this ever since the 60s when they stopped making black and white films that people thought that black and white movies look old or no one will see a black and white film. Whereas previous to that time, from the 30s on, there were always black and white films and color films. And they just said, this movie should be black and white. This movie should be color. Wouldn't it be great? Because this year we have Maestro, which made a lot of money, largely in black and white. Yeah. Oppenheimer, which is maybe a quarter in black and white. Mm-hmm. A couple of years ago, we had Belfast, which did really well, largely in black and white. The Coen brothers or Joel Coen, Macbeth, black and white. Yes. Like maybe we're actually at a place where people will go like, people will go see a black and white movie because it is stunningly beautiful.
Yeah.
And there are things you could do in black and white that you can't do in color. The way that we process information is different. The way that we see light is different. The use of shadows is different. The effect, I mean, like nobody would go like, oh, you know, I like those Ansel Adams photos of Yosemite, but they'd be so much better in color. Thinks that, know, it's like, no, this is a beautiful art form. And I just hope that we get more of it.
Well, I think it's been making a comeback, right? Let me run you through a list of these real quick. I know we want to keep these short, but Emancipation, segments of that was in black and white. The first edition of Werewolf by Night on Disney Plus was in black and white. Blonde had black and white in it. We may not like the film, but it had black and white. Come On, Come On was basically all in black and white. The Joaquin Phoenix film from 2 years ago here. You mentioned Macbeth as well. Mank was in black
and
Mank,
white. Oh, Mank, yeah.
Right? The Lighthouse. A fantastic film from Robert Eggers with Robert Pattinson, Willem Dafoe was in black and white. Cold War was in black and white, which also got nominated. Roma was in black and white as well. And we've been seeing quite a number of this usage coming back here from these directors to use them in the right situations. Even Nebraska from a few years ago from Alexander Payne was in black and white. So I like that we're starting now to see directors not be afraid to use it, and because they're using it in the right situations and in the right way to tell their stories. And it's fantastic to see that. We got to talk before we got to hit a couple more things, but we certainly got to talk about this scene. Steve, your thoughts here on this testing scene. It was an extended sequence of the entire movie from setting it up, seeing the pressure that they got to get this test done, the rain, all the things they had to go through, driving out there to test it. And then when it finally happened and how the sound design dropped out and you got to experience this as if you were there yourself and see all the massive flashes and explosions and everything that happened to everybody who was there who witnessed it. Your thoughts on this scene from the film?
I think I said when we were doing Maestro, this idea of having to deliver on the promise of the premise, which is that in Maestro, we got to see him conduct. And when he conducts, it has to be awesome. You know, if you hear about a character, you know, in Coda, you know, where you're talking about this person sing and then they sing their audition. Well, that better, you better deliver. If you don't deliver this thing you've been setting up to, the movie's in deep trouble. Well, this is as big a thing as we've been setting up to in any film ever. It's like, we are going to explode the first atomic bomb. And what's so strange about it, I think, is that we're trepidatious through the whole movie, even knowing what happened in history. We're trepidatious both because, is this the right thing? Like, do we really want to, is building an atomic weapon a good idea? But then we've also been introduced to the idea that there is some chance that we could destroy the world. Yeah. And even though we're here today, we know that that didn't happen. It's still set up with all this tension. And then the attention to detail of showing each component, where each person is, the clock typing down, the people putting the sunscreen stuff on their face, whether you have the glasses on, where you're going to be, how far away each of these stations are, what we're going to see, what we're going to hear. And then, and man, as you say, they deliver the sound dropping off, the light, the expression, the reactions of people, and then hearing that line of, I've become Shiva, destroyer of worlds. Mm. Like that is, dude. And then the sound hitting. It is, and I don't know how long the sequence is. I bet it's 15 to 20 minutes, probably the whole sequence. I don't know.
20,
Yeah. And it totally is 100% captivating and delivers.
I think what you said, you got to deliver on the promise of the premise. And that absolutely happened in that scene. 100% agree with you. Before we go, I do want to give a shout out here. Your thoughts on the score here. Ludwig Göransson winning a second Oscar after having won for Black Panther. I thought it was, this is a score I go back to and listen to, Steve. You know me, I'm not a score whore. I rarely purchase scores. I rarely download scores. but I already have Dune Part Two, and I've had Oppenheimer rolling through 2023 ever since I saw the movie. This is a haunting, haunting score that stays with you. Yet in some strange way, it also kind of inspires you. So it's a fascinating score. What did you think about the score throughout the movie?
Well, first of all, just to respond to that before I get to the score.
Sure.
This is an inspiring story.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a tragic story,
sure.
But it is a story of incredibly brilliant humans
yep.
working incredibly hard to accomplish an almost impossible task. Mm-hmm. So the outcome might not be inspiring. And I think the movie handles all that really well,
yeah.
but it is still an incredible, it's one of the great achievements of human history, idea of pulling this off. And it might be one of the great tragedies of human history. I'm going to say it's the weirdest thing I've ever said about a score.
Please.
I think the score is amazing because of the fact I didn't notice it at all.
Wow.
Do you know what I mean? Like there are moments because I can think of like some of the moments of the score, but mostly I was so completely involved in the film. I wasn't tracking it. And I'm sure if we do it for the Cinephiles, which maybe it'll be 10 years from now, maybe it'll be less, then I really will pay attention. But like, I never split my focus out of the film enough to be focusing on the score.
Well, I'll say this. Christian came up with a really interesting idea today on The Big Thing, that he is going to bring back a certain thing once he hits a certain number of patrons. Maybe we use that as motivation to be sure. Once we hit a certain number of patrons, we will do Oppenheimer, a full-on Cinephiles. Five episode long. Or if someone wants to donate at the highest level that we have there, maybe we will break our rule and do Oppenheimer. That would be a lot of fun. I don't mean just one person. I mean, quite a number of people would have to donate at that level for us to break the 10-year rule. So just something to think about maybe as we go forward. But no, I love the score. I noticed it was one of the first thing I noticed when I watched the movie, just got caught up in what it was doing. And I remember going on YouTube immediately, hooking up my phone in the car and listening to it as I drove home from the screening. And I've listened to it ever since in different times because I just love that score so much. So Ludwig Göransson, a well-deserved Oscar, and I was very, very happy he won last night. All right, well, there we go. That's our overall conversation on Oppenheimer. I'm sure there's so much more we could discuss, but we were trying to keep these to around 30 minutes. We're already past that time now, so we should wrap up here. A winner of 7 Oscars, an incredible film. Steve, your final thoughts on Oppenheimer as we wrap up? For now.
Exactly the point, is for now. I think this is going to go down as one of the great films.
Yeah,
I really do. That's like a film like Lawrence of Arabia, like a film like Citizen Kane, like a film like, you know, The Bridge on the River Kwai, like these kinds of a film, I'm going to go back to it.
Yeah.
And this is, you know, it's like, I love Big Trouble in Little China. There are no mysteries about Big Trouble in Little China that I have yet to plumb. Even like, I love Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan.
Don't get me wrong. I love Big Trouble in Little China.
but with Lawrence of Arabia or Citizen Kane,
yeah.
I will never, ever, ever plumb the depths of those films, regardless of how many times I watch them or how much I read or how much I study or how much I think. Yeah. That's the kind of film Oppenheimer is, in my opinion.
I agree with you 100%. We will never finish plumbing the depths of the great films because we're always going to get something different out of them every time we watch them because of things that are going on in our lives. And I've said this for numerous years since I got into this space. That's what makes a classic film classic. You can go and revisit it anytime in your life and you will pull something new out of it that you didn't notice before, along with all the other things that you already pulled out of it from before. Oppenheimer, 6 times now, as I said, I've seen it. Every single time something new strikes me, something new hits me, some delivery of a line stays with me, some concept that they're debating, some feeling, some of the decisions that are made, and especially with David Krumholtz, some of those back and forths he has with Oppenheimer in discussing what he's doing stick with me and stay with me as well. So there's so much about this movie that stays with me, and I think it's one that I agree with Steve is going to be one we're going to go back to and reevaluate and reappreciate for many, many years to come, and may at the end be one of the top best pictures of the 21st century. Once we wrap up the 21st century, we may be talking about Oppenheimer in the top 5 It may be Toppenheimer, so to speak. So we will see. All right. Well, thank you all so much for joining us for this third installment of 10 Days of Oscars. We'll be back with a brand new movie tomorrow to talk about it and have some fun discussing it with you all. Thanks for listening. Thanks for watching. Steve, tell them where they can find you and where they can follow the Cinephiles in case they're new people here.
Well, it's SR Morris on Twitter, SR Morris 1 on Instagram to follow me. Cinephiles is Cine_files on Twitter, the Cinephiles podcast on Instagram. If you want to support the show, it's right up on the top of the stream, patreon.com/thecinephiles, where you can hear ad-free versions of the show. You can listen to our Cinephiles shorts. You can listen to our watch-alongs, join our Cinephiles advisory board and chart the future of the Cinephiles. You can buy or stream all the films we reviewed on the show at cinephiles.net. And right now we're in the midst of our epic season of Scorsese. In fact, right when we get off this recording, we're going to jump on to talk more about Raging Bull. After Raging Bull, we're going to jump into The Last Temptation of Christ. So we have some serious, serious, heavy stuff going on in the Cinephiles right now, and it's really exciting.
Absolutely. All right, I'm at The Roca Says on Twitter and Instagram. Thank you all so much for joining us, and we'll talk to you next time with another brand new installment here in the 10 Days of Oscars from the Cinephiles. Take care until then.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.